Why is it, do you think, children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to, systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education?
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org.
Welcome to Teachers for Class War. It is Monday, January 26th. Today on our show, we're going to do a quick bit of breaking news, a little bit of information about Leonard Peltier, a Brown Beret in Riverside who was shot dead. And then after that, we're going to go on to an interview, check out the status of the civil rights in American schools these days. We have an interview with Genevieve Segal Howley. Before we do that, we're going to do a short piece on Rosa Parks with commentary by Professor Tim Tyson, talking about sort of the myth of Rosa Parks and what was actually behind that story, just in case you're not aware.
Right on. Welcome to Teachers for Class War. So indeed, a real quick update on Leonard Peltier. He was recently transferred to Cannon Federal Penitentiary. He had been in Leavenworth forever, and then he ended up in Pennsylvania, and he's been transferred again. And if that wasn't enough of an issue, he was beaten upon arrival in the prison population at his new spot. So Peltier is over 60 years old, half blind, diabetic, and perhaps the world's most famous political prisoner. Him and Mamiya are a good toss-up, but for him to be beaten upon arrival is not too uncommon for general prisoners as a jumping in this slavery prison system in this nation. But for someone with as much of a spotlight on him, it's pretty incredible. There's information on Indie Bay on the Santa Cruz page and on the regular old indiebay.org for the whole San Francisco Bay Area, and a press release and such. But basically, I'll just read the first paragraph. My brother Leonard was severely beaten upon his arrival at the Cannon Federal Penitentiary. When he went into population after his transfer, some inmates assaulted him. The severity of his injuries is that he suffered numerous blows to his head and body, received a large bump on the head, possibly a concussion, numerous bruises. One of his fingers is swollen and discolored. He has pain in his chest and rib cage, and there is blood everywhere from his injuries. Due to the attack, he was placed in solitary confinement and given only one meal, which is pretty dangerous for a diabetic. This is generally done in prison when you won't name your attackers. Prison officials refuse to release any information to the family, but they need to hear from his supporters to protect his safety. His attorneys are trying to get calls to him now. So this is breaking last week. This is, going on currently, so check out leonardpeltier.info and IndieBay for more information about that. And then, as we mentioned as well, there was a candlelight vigil in Watsonville last night on Sunday due to the murder of Annette Garcia. She's a Brown Beret de Aztlan in Southern California in Riverside. She's a mother of three, and on Wednesday evening, she was shot in the back by a Riverside County Sheriff's deputy. The name of that shooter, the cop, has not been released, but I'm just going to read quickly from a blog called White Light, Black Light, posted earlier today. More police brutality. Annette Garcia, a mother of three, shot to death by Riverside sheriffs. On Friday, January 23rd, Annette Garcia was shot to death by Riverside sheriffs after they received calls that she was suicidal and under duress due to a marriage dispute. Reports by the family and witnesses are that she posed no harm to the officers involved and was shot at six times until a bullet finally hit her in the back as she ran for cover. It took over an hour to get medical attention, and she died in the arms of her own children. Due to this outrage and other recent police misconduct and abuses around the nation, community members from Watsonville and Santa Cruz have held a candlelight vigil. Participants held signs demanding an end to police brutality, justice for Oscar Grant and Rudy Cardenas. Other actions are planned for the upcoming week. A lot of folks are, linking. This list is growing. Annette Garcia, Oscar Grant, Sean Bell, Gary King. This is ongoing, and it has to stop. So stay tuned and get more information about that at brownberets.info. Probably later in the evening tonight, you will hear a report back on the Global Local from that particular vigil and protest. So stay tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz for that. And from here, we'll hear a little bit of history that you might not have heard about Rosa Parks.
From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners.
Support your local. So you may be a little surprised that we're putting an NPR segment on, but trust me, this quick 5-minute bit is surprising for NPR's listenership. I was not expecting them to tell us about how Rosa Parks had guns in her closet. So stay tuned for a second, and we will hear that.
Yeah, sorry about the commercial notice here or the pledge drive-ish stuff, but you know how the nonprofit industrial complex does it. So
while you're at it, if you feel like slinging some cash in the direction of Free Radio, you can do that. freakradio.org. There's a PayPal account, or you could do it to P.O. Box 767, Santa Cruz, California.
Concert was held in the mall in which a parade of stars performed. One, actor Samuel L. Jackson, recounted a pivotal moment in the struggle for civil rights.
There have been many foot soldiers in the quest for justice. One was an Alabama department store seamstress. In 1955, tired from her long day of work, she brought that distant hope one step closer by the simple act of refusing to move to the back of the bus. This is what Rosa Parks said. I did not get on the bus to get arrested. I got on the bus to go home. I had no idea that history was being made. I was just tired of giving in. Somehow I felt I was right to stand up to that bus driver. I knew I could have been lynched or beaten when the police came. I chose not to move. I knew that I had the strength of my ancestors with me.
Yes, she chose not to move, and she risked a great deal to do it. Yes, she surely had the strength of her ancestors with her, but no, the idea of making history could not have been far from her mind. Americans revere the courage of Rosa Parks, but the real Rosa Parks was more than the simple seamstress of legend. So to correct the record, we'll replay an excerpt of an interview we did on the occasion of Parks' death with Tim Tyson, who's now a visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke Divinity School and a senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke. He told us that Parks was active in the civil rights movement and that the movement was looking, waiting for someone like Rosa to make a stand.
They were, in fact, looking for such a thing. Within a year, there had been a couple of cases of black women arrested on the buses who they almost had a boycott around, but who weren't just right in one way or another. And so they were sort of waiting for this case. They did not say, however, Mrs. Parks, would you mind going and getting arrested on the bus today? We're ready to do the bus boycott. When she got arrested, the word went forth, and people in the community knew what would happen.
And yet, the Washington Post, in its appreciation of Rosa Parks, referred very much to her as a seamstress and very little to her as an activist. It did nothing to squelch the myth that she was just one woman who on a certain day had had enough. Why do you suppose that myth endures?
I think for some reason we're unwilling to honor people who are politically active. We want to honor people who just have had enough and sort of spontaneously won't take it anymore. But somehow if they get categorized as active citizens, which would be a positive way of saying it, as troublemakers, which is the way we often think about such persons, then somehow it becomes self-serving, part of a movement which we're less comfortable with. And I think that's just an American popular cultural narrative that we pick up very quickly. And indeed, that started very quickly after the bus boycott. They talked about her tired feet. That gets mentioned a lot more often than it should. She may have been a little bit tired, but that had nothing to do with the decision that she made.
In that same Washington Post obituary, there was, it seemed, a palpable sense of disappointment that the myth is, in fact, a myth. Why are we so reluctant to let it go?
There's a sense in which Mrs. Parks is very important to our post-civil rights racial narrative, because we really want a kind of sugar-coated civil rights movement that's about purity and interracial nonviolence. And so we don't really want to meet the real Rosa Parks. We don't, for example, want to know that in the late 1960s, Rosa Parks became a black nationalist and a great admirer of Malcolm X. I met Rosa Parks at the funeral of Robert F. Williams, who had fought the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina with a machine gun in the late 1950s and then fled to Cuba and had been a kind of international revolutionary icon of black power. Ms. Parks delivered the eulogy at his funeral. She talks in her autobiography and says that she never believed in nonviolence and that she was incapable of that herself and that she kept guns in her home to protect her family. But we want a little old lady with tired feet. You may have noticed we don't have a lot of pacifist white heroes. We prefer our black people meek and mild, I think.
Was she ambivalent about her place in history?
I think she was a seasoned political activist who knew that it was useful for her to seem apolitical. But the myth was only useful, really, in 1955 and 1956. But as the years go by, of course, historians didn't do much better. We expect historians to dig a little deeper than just the politics of image. Of course, I think there's also a serious gender element to this in that when male politicians are quite forceful, you know, we like that. I think we prefer our women to be demure and modest and unassuming and unaware.
We spoke to Tim Tyson.
All right, hope you enjoyed that piece. A little revolutionary for NPR, but I'm stoked to replay it and know that that stuff's out there for more conservative listeners on more conservative stations. You're listening to Teachers for Class War, Free Radio Santa Cruz. I wanted to reiterate our P.O. box just in case I got it wrong last time. If you want to send any donations, love mail, hate mail, any of that sort of stuff, our address is Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. I know you all were running for your pads of paper so that you could write that down anyways, so, you know, thanks. As a teacher in Pajaro Valley, I got some news today. The rumors have been flying like crazy, as this letter that I got confirms, about budget information. So I'm just going to read it out loud. Just take it as a public service announcement. This is what's going on locally in the schools. To all PVUSD employees regarding budget information. Over the next few weeks, there will be many proposals, rumors, and information coming out of Sacramento and even from within the district that may not be accurate. Given how serious the situation is and realizing how important accurate information is, the superintendent of business and I will be sending out regular communication to all employees on Fridays to update everyone with any new information from the state and any updates from the district. Unfortunately, the political quagmire between the legislative Democrats, Republicans, and the governor continues to create an ever-increasing state deficit, which is being passed on to districts and schools to resolve. As of January 9th, the governor published his 2009-2010 budget proposal. Even without the proposal being approved by the legislature, districts will be required by the county to meet those budget reductions as outlined in the proposal. For Pajaro Valley Unified, it will mean reducing our expenditures by $17 million in order to balance our 2009-2010 budget. Coming on the heels of an $8 million reduction at the end of 2007-2008 school year, and given the extreme amount of reductions necessary to meet the new budget requirements, all departments district-wide and school sites will be affected by the reductions, which will, in turn, affect all district employees. Currently, the district will be reviewing all open positions, hiring subs, or not filling positions based on need and potential reductions. All supplies, services, and equipment purchases will also be reviewed, only approving critical need and/or obligation. With the board facing $17 million of reductions on a budget that is over 80% personnel, we know that the reductions will necessitate the loss of many positions. At the next board meeting on January 28th, the budget will be on the agenda for discussion as the board gathers information to determine the list of reductions to be made to reach a $17 million budget deficit. Any employees in certificated positions, that's teachers, that are identified for possible reduction will have to be notified by March 15th. Employees in classified positions that may be reduced will need to receive a notice 45 days prior to the end of the school year. Budget cuts, staff cuts, translate into reduced services, which in turn adversely impact the quality of education for our students. When the district cuts staff, successful programs are cut along with them. Other critical services that create successful learning environments suffer in this budget crisis as well. It is my sincere hope that as an educational community, we will work together to minimize the impact to all PVUSD employees and conserve as many positions as possible. In addition to that, it might be worth remarking that Mariposa Art and Abraxas, which is the boys' sort of compartment or section of Mariposa Art, which is Mariposa is art and leadership classes for girls, and Abraxas would be art and leadership combination for boys. Those both just got trashed completely. They had been really, really beautiful, successful programs. One of them is the Abraxas program is taught in my classroom after school. And it's really, really sad to see it go. The male teacher who had a group of boys was really creating some beautiful relationships with his boys. He was teaching them about just the beauty standard for women and how most of the models are airbrushed or anorexic. He was teaching them about gardening. He was teaching them about exercise and keeping their metabolism proper, making sure they eat healthy food. He was teaching them about all sorts of things, just basic life skills that they're not getting on their bubble tests at the end of the year. So it's real. It's sad to see that stuff getting cut, but it's there. So that's the local report. A bit depressing, but we've also got, we've got the good stuff going on as well. A lot of great stories. Right, we've got Genevieve Siegel Howley on the line. Just to do a quick bio, I'm going to read her bio from the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. Genevieve Siegel Howley is a doctoral student in urban schooling at the University of California, Los Angeles' Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. Her research interests focus on examining the impact of resegregation in American schools. Siegel Howley worked as a research assistant at the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights from 2000 to 2001, where she developed data on court-ordered school systems, in addition to compiling and processing data from the 30 years of survey collection in elementary and secondary school civil rights compliance report. She taught 4 years of high school history in Baltimore, Maryland, and Richmond, Virginia. Siegel Howley is the recipient of the Fitz Turner Commission for Human Relations and Civil Rights Award for her efforts to ensure access and equity for students of color at regional magnet high schools in Virginia. At a regional magnet high school in Virginia. She received her BA from the University of Virginia, her MAT in secondary studies, secondary social studies education from Johns Hopkins University, and her Master's of Education, Policy and Management from Harvard University. During her time at Harvard, Ms. Siegel Howley worked as a research assistant at the Civil Rights Project and assisted in the editing process for Lessons in Integration, Realizing the Promise of Racial Diversity in America's Schools. She is the current editor of the Integration Report for the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, a biweekly web publication that provides news and updates on desegregation efforts around the country.
Genevieve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. So, welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We wanted to talk to you about the report that's just been released, but man, in that bio, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that we want to talk to you about too. So we're hoping you have some time to discuss the recently released report, Reviving the Goal, and then to talk some about your other experience as well. If you could begin by just kind of going into the Reviving the Goal report, how it came about, and what kind of data is out there from the Civil Rights Project right now?
Sure. And thank you guys again for having me on. I was not actually a co-author on the report, but I work for the Civil Rights Project, and am very familiar with it. The Civil Rights Project has been releasing an annual report on or around Martin Luther King's birthday every year for the past 13. And the purpose of the report is to provide sort of a summary of where the country is in terms of segregation annually. And I think really it started after the director of the Civil Rights Project, Gary Orfield, had written a book describing sort of the retreat from desegregation policies around the country. So every year since it's been released, the statistics and the numbers have shown a reversal of the gains that were made in the 70s and 80s when desegregation was sort of at the forefront of the national conversation. So this year's report was obviously a timely one because it was also the dawn of the new Obama administration and all of the promise that may lie in that. Because really, for the past 30 to 40 years, we've seen either administrations embrace regressive civil rights policies that have damaged the goal of racially integrated schools, or, you know, during the Carter and the Clinton administrations, while they may not have been regressive, they certainly weren't going after the issues. So this report both outlines, as it has in previous years, where we are with segregation in the country, and I'm going to take you through some of those numbers. But it also provides some policy recommendations for what the Obama administration might do, at least here at the outset, to confront some of these issues.
That sounds wonderful. We're both particularly interested in some recommendations and a little bit of solution-oriented speech, so thanks for going there.
Okay, well, I know, and it really, it's uplifting at the end of the report because some of these numbers are fairly dismal. I think the two big trends that come forward, and some might see them as contradictory. I know I was talking to my mom, and I'm trying to explain, and she brought up a point that I think a lot of people will have. And so one is that while we're seeing deepening segregation for Black and Latino students in the United States, we're also seeing increasing racial diversity, so that a student population that in 1968, which is the first year federal data was collected on this issue, the white students made up nearly 80% of the student population. And today that number is around 54%.
So can you define for our listeners what you mean by segregation? I know what? Because I work in a school that's, well, yeah. I won't go there. I won't go into my personal circumstances, but I know what you mean. But I just think for the purposes of our listeners, that would be important.
Yes, it definitely. It was an oversight on my part. And I was a teacher, too, and I know there are probably lots of teachers listening. So I want to hear about your experiences in Santa Cruz as well. Segregation, meaning that students are attending schools that are less diverse than they were during the height of desegregation in the country. And sometimes people talk about hyper-segregated schools, and those would be schools where 90 to 100% of the students were of the same race.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yep, that's where I teach.
Yeah, I do. And also, there are different definitions. So a lot of districts think about the overall racial composition mm-hmm. of their school district, and then theoretically, a school should reflect the composition. So if the district is 60% white, then schools should be fairly within that number, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But a big trend is that there's a lot of segregation between districts, not within them, so that our cities have become so segregated that often the white population has declined to maybe 10%.
Absolutely.
But, you know, just beyond the border in the counties, you'll have a much higher percentage of white students. So that's segregation between districts, and it's mm-hmm. very difficult to counteract.
Mm-hmm. We definitely see that in Santa Cruz.
It really is not a pattern.
We do see something like that.
What are your school district demographics?
I don't know the exact demographics down to the percentage, but what we tend to see is I teach in Pajaro Valley School District, which is Watsonville and Aptos, two neighboring cities. They're adjacent to each other, and they are covered by the same district. And we see a lot of labeling of North Zone, Central Zone, and South Zone. And mm-hmm. The North Zone, which tends to have a whiter population, not tends to, it does have a whiter population,
right.
and is not the schools like mine that are, you know, 90 to 100% Mexican-American or Latino, with a few exceptions for Filipinos, Blacks, and, you know, a minority of white students.
Right.
The North Zone has, you know, there are all sorts of rumors out there, but what we understand is that there have been movements to actually secede from our district. Which, you know, of course, I have a million opinions on. And then we also see that the neighboring district to the north, Santa Cruz, is more dominantly a white district.
Okay.
And
I would respond to say that those patterns are not unusual.
Right. It's also interesting to look at the difference in teacher salaries, you know, if you travel 5 or 10 miles north. It's a pretty stark comparison at times.
Well, and, you know, getting caught up in the numbers, and it's easy to lose sight of, you know, why segregation matters, and things like fewer resources, less experience, less qualified teachers, lower teacher salaries. You know, all of those things are related to mm-hmm. segregated and hyper-segregated environments. Although, you know, I think it's important to name the elephant in the room and say that really there's been a lessened commitment desegregation after mm-hmm. so many years.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you about that, because the question of why it matters, I feel like there's a kind of simplistic view, or we heard a little bit earlier a clip, a news clip just about Rosa Parks, and with MLK Day just passing,
right.
we counter this kind of simplistic civil rights era as a past era view of segregation and desegregation as both a given and something that's done and over.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm finding, and what we're talking about, is why do we have to argue that it's necessary again? Like, why do we have to once again try to prove that integration is a good idea? Like, because we can say that the data's gotten worse and schools have again segregated.
Right.
And there are trends that show that. But why do we have to once again try to argue that that's a problem?
I mean, that is an issue that, I mean, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I talking to my mom, she said, well, you know, back then there was so much opposition from whites, and it, you know, the thought of going to school with a student of another race was terrifying, and it provoked all this outrage. But today, that's gone, she said. And you know, white students do go to school with students of other backgrounds, and it's not a big deal anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and those numbers are there, it's simply because white students are declining as their share of the population. So they would obviously have to be going to schools that are more diverse. But still, today, the average white student goes to a school where three-quarters of their peers are white.
Mm-hmm.
White students are the most racially isolated group. And that number was 85%, you know, 20 years ago. So it is declining. They are going to more diverse schools. But it is still possible to have the deepening segregation. And I think one of the problems is that so many people don't see it because they are so isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And that segregation is not a reality for them. And then on the other side, communities of color resist the idea that they need to be sitting next to white students in order to learn. Partly after just so many years of it not working out and 20 years of reversal. It's just, you know, let's move on. Let's think of a different solution.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would argue that there is no other solution that would really work.
It seems like economics play into this also. I mean, that's kind of, I don't know, probably beating a dead horse in a lot of respects, but it seems like there's a, you know, even though schools might be more integrated in terms of skin color, I don't think they're more integrated in terms of economic diversity within individual schools.
Yes, and there's a lot of research to support that, and, you know, schools are doubly or triply segregated by poverty and race or by mm-hmm. poverty, race, and language.
Exactly.
So more than incompetence or a lack of regulation on the part of federal regulators or this or that, how did this happen? How does it happen? Is it gerrymandered districts or vouchers or shady backroom deals or No Child Left Behind? What is it that has allowed and in fact encouraged these numbers to worsen rather than improve?
Right. Well, you know, I'm from Richmond, Virginia. Which was the capital of the Confederacy during the Civil War, and I'm from the South, and the South took some deservedly hard knocks during those early years of desegregation. They mounted massive resistance. They closed public schools. They sent their children, white parents sent their children to private schools. But in the end, the broad mandate from the courts implemented some of the most far-reaching desegregation plans in the country, including the case in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, where they decided to allow busing so that you could bus students away from residentially segregated neighborhoods into more diverse schools. And after, you know, it took 10 years for the South to get on board, but after 10 or 15 years of really sweeping desegregation plans that were implemented and overseen by the courts, it was the most integrated region in the country. And those gains lasted until the 1990s. But the politics behind this are you just can't be overlooked. And the fact is that beginning with the Nixon administration, federal support was really rolled back. And that continued into the Reagan administration, and a series of judicial appointments changed the composition of the Supreme Court in a way that it began the reversal of the court's support of desegregation. And starting in the 1990s, the early 1990s, three court decisions sort of allowed the lower level, the district courts, to say, okay, this school district has done all it can, even in the face of evidence that there was still segregation. The school district has done all it can do. We will release them from judicial oversight. And since then, since 1991, segregation for blacks has worsened every year. So I would pinpoint sort of this tide of resegregation to that era, to the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
and for Latino students who were rarely resided in cities that were under desegregation plans in the West, in particular, desegregation wasn't implemented as fully as it was in the South. They have been segregating every year since data was collected, since 1968.
Yeah, unfortunately, we feel that.
Well, yes. And that's what I meant about this kind of simplistic black and white civil rights era image of the word segregation only has those connotations. People don't think of segregation in the Southwest between Latino students and white students because that's something different, or that's a non-issue, or that's an immigration issue, but people don't name it segregation.
Right. And I think that's incredibly important to start that dialogue and continue that dialogue in very detailed terms.
So how
there were a couple of cases out here, but they weren't they were sort of piecemeal, few and far between.
How has the this year's report been received? Is there any momentum? As you said, there's include some recommendations and policy recommendations, but how has the reception been this year?
Well, you know, I know that there's been a lot of interest from the media. I would hazard a guess that Professor Orfield has been on the receiving end of any higher level interest, and I'm not privy to that yet. But I think every year the response is encouraging because people see it and they, as you all have, they feel it very personally in their own communities and want to know more about it. So if you'd like to turn to some of those policy recommendations.
Certainly.
Okay. And with maybe a little bit more hopeful in the beginning of the conversation.
Here's all the bad news. Now, what's the plan?
Well, I think fundamentally what can't be overlooked is just the power of positive leadership on these issues. You know, for so many years, we've either had somebody in the executive office that either is actively opposing desegregation and busing and all these words that have these negative connotations, or they've ignored it as too politically volatile. So having somebody just acknowledge the harms that are still associated with segregated schools, which Obama did in that Philadelphia speech on race relations, he said segregated schools were and are inferior schools. And so number one is just having leadership that acknowledges that these are troubling patterns. In addition to the segregation, we've got rapidly changing racial demographics, which means that there are schools that are becoming really diverse, but we don't have teachers in place or administrators in place that really know how to harness these benefits and instead can segregate their students within the school by tracking them. So some serious federal attention needs to be paid to these issues. And one of the ways to do that is to commission more research so that we can complicate that old notion of segregation as a black-white issue that you were talking about and establish some new definitions of desegregation and desegregation goals that are more in keeping with where we are now as a country in terms of our diversity. They can be more proactive in recommending best practices for school districts that are based on research, telling school districts how to harness the benefits that are associated with diversity. School choice, I know you guys mentioned vouchers earlier. Do you guys have charter schools in your district?
We do,
yes.
And what are the demographics of their charter schools compared to the district?
They're pretty different. In fact, there's actually kind of a controversy going on with one of our larger charter schools right now. There's one called Pacific Collegiate up in the Santa Cruz district that's getting a fair amount of heat for their racial demographics because they're supposedly selecting by lottery, but, you know, what's happening behind closed doors, we don't exactly know, and why they're hiring for a new principal, we also don't exactly know. So they've got a lot of heat right now, and hopefully those racial demographics will be changing, but yeah, they fall right in line with what you're saying.
And and somehow that school has also been ranked in the top nationwide public charter school charts.
It's like number two or number three this year.
According to tests. Wow. And so what we're looking at is this, you know, supposedly superstar local school that doesn't have the same community support in certain communities.
Mm-hmm.
Or for certain communities.
That's great.
Another thing that I think is really important, I mean, we're talking about integration of schools, and I feel like one of the things that is just taken for granted is that what we mean is integration of student populations. But I, as a teacher, really want to look at integration of staff populations. Who is the administration? Who's on the district, you know, board? If you're in a 99% Latino district, I'd like to see that representation from the community, and of course with the teachers as well. I'd like to be working with a staff that's roughly in proportion, or, you know, even somewhat leaning in the direction of balanced.
Right.
Because my staff is overwhelmingly white, and our students are overwhelmingly Latino, and that cultural divide is really a problem for us.
Yeah, and I think that's another dimension of the issue, and it historically has been recognized as such. But the teaching population today is 85% white and female.
Exactly, and generally sort of middle class.
Mm-hmm. So that disconnect is very troubling.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's part of the same problem, but a whole nother conversation about the pipeline and training programs and what the requirements are.
Do you all do any research on that?
Yes, actually. There are a couple of reports on the website. One is called Are Teachers Prepared for Racially Diverse Schools?
Uh-huh.
And I can send that link to Daniel.
That would be wonderful.
Or email. And there's another one called The Segregation of American Teachers.
Great.
On the website.
Yeah, I look forward to dropping a couple of copies of that in my staff room. Potentially.
And before we go too much further with that, the can you talk about briefly the website and the organization that you're working with? Of course, recently moved from Harvard, and just the Civil Rights Project.
Yes. The website is... Now I have it pulled up, but you think I know. www.civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, and Civil Rights Project is all one word. And it was published at Harvard University, and it moved out here, I guess, 2 years ago now. And I've followed it faithfully. but, you know, it's dedicated to keeping civil rights issues at the forefront. Of the national agenda, which at the time of its establishment, they were certainly on the back burner in a lot of ways. And I think the excitement around what could possibly be a very dramatic change in that area is evident in the organization. But, you know, school integration is a big piece of it. The project was involved in the affirmative action cases at the higher ed level in 2003. The school-to-prison pipeline, dropout rates. The co-director, Patricia Gondra, is really interested in language issues. There are a ton of things that you can find on the website. Special education and the implications of that for students. So, lots of good stuff.
That's really excellent. Thanks for providing all of that information and letting our listeners know about the website.
Yeah, I'm plugging it left and right.
If you've got another minute to talk to us, I would love to hear, I mean, just from reading your bio, we had a whole list of questions, but then from reading your bio, I thought, oh, she's been a classroom teacher for 4 years. I'm really interested in what you think about the intersections between classroom teaching and policymaking, and how having actually taught in a school for 4 years has influenced you in terms of policy and research.
Mm-hmm. You know, I miss teaching so much, but it was so hard while I was in the classroom in the midst of it to really wrap my mind around just the day-to-day interactions and politics of the school and the classroom and what they meant. Mm-hmm. And so I took a break in between those 4 years. At the end of my second year, I went back to school and thought some more about it, but then I couldn't be away from the classroom, and I went back to school.
Uh-huh.
I think that they are inextricably linked, and that the teachers' voices are just a tremendously important piece of the puzzle and should be tapped when policy decisions are made.
I've been watching federal politics and looking at the number of, you know, sort of professional lawmakers that are out there getting jobs regarding educational policy. And that really worries me because I keep seeing militarization and sort of, what do they call it, business model schools popping up as these celebrated, wonderful events.
Yeah.
And that just so does not resonate with me or other teachers I know. Quite the contrary, actually.
Yes, and, you know, the optimistic view of that would be to say it was a product of a very market-oriented, conservative political climate, but I'm not so sure. And so one of the things about school choice, which, you know, in the past 10 years, 20 years, has been about vouchers and charter schools, is that when it's implemented with consideration for civil rights issues, so that when schools have a lot of outreach to all communities, or they provide free transportation, or they use lotteries instead of competitive admissions processes, although it sounds like the one in your district might be doing something under the rug, but that there are ways to structure these new choice programs that could at least attempt to combat some of the segregation that they are causing.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I worry about is parent education levels and linguistic barriers of parents, you know, parents not knowing that they need to get in there and do a kindergarten registration at the charter school, or fearing that their immigration status will be found out if they start to make their presence known in public institutions, things like that. Do you have any ideas as to how that could be worked with or worked into the system a little more effectively?
Well, I think that outreach has to include brochures and information that is widely available in different languages.
Mm-hmm.
And community meetings where a representative from the school goes and meets with parents. But that is a researched reality, that parents that are more connected with more information are the ones that apply for those spots.
Right.
So, and that is why they tend to be more segregated.
Mm-hmm.
Those schools. But, you know, magnet schools, which people never talk about anymore, but of which there are many, many all over the country. I'm a graduate of a magnet program in Richmond. They were created for the purpose of desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
And they include often, not always anymore, but often many of those civil rights considerations that are missing in the newer forms of choice.
Interesting.
And there's
also
a report on that on the website as well.
Uh-huh. So that represents sort of another step backwards, it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah.
So in terms of the report and the policy recommendations and the power of positive leadership, before you go, I'm hoping you can comment briefly on No Child Left Behind and hopes for any change, scrapping, reform, destruction. And Arne Duncan is the choice for education secretary.
Mm-hmm. Arne Duncan certainly seems like did a lot of interesting things in Chicago. He is a proponent of charter schools along with Obama. And so I would say that looking carefully at more oversight for charter schools and also including some federal provisions for making sure that those schools make every effort to reach out to the communities that they're serving and also are cognizant of their propensity to resegregate students. Would be important. No Child Left Behind, I think, you know, it's been part of the national dialogue that sort of has refocused our attention away from desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
And the emphasis on accountability and standards and testing has often punished the most racially and socioeconomically isolated schools. I think there's some promise in the transfer provisions that are sort of underutilized, but that allow students to transfer to a higher performing school. And if that could be out of district,
mm-hmm.
then that might move in the direction of integrating
mm-hmm.
more. And the piece about highly qualified teachers is not always implemented very effectively, but pulling the most talented and the most qualified teachers into the most underserved schools would certainly be a potential benefit if it were implemented.
Right. I mean, that seems pretty key to me. It seems like we shouldn't get a bunch of first-year people into the toughest schools. It seems like we should be getting the people who have been there for 5 years, who are energized and excited still, but also know how to control a classroom and how to teach properly.
Absolutely. I did Teach for America in Baltimore, and there were 5 teachers at my school at the beginning of the year, and 3 were gone by November. Not to knock Teach for America too hard, but...
Right, but proper training counts for something.
Right. In general, the less experienced teachers are the least likely to stay.
Right.
And currently to be certified as you know, having had that training, is from what I've heard from, you know, credentialed teachers who are certified, qualified, my goodness, those trainings are dismal and useless.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's an area of research that I think the federal government could fund and then help disseminate best practices, best professional development.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a whole other same problem, but different dimension.
Yeah, well, it seems like we could keep you on air for at least another 4 hours talking about these things.
Yes. For sure, but the report is definitely on the website, and, you know, it goes into sort of how the Department of Education and the Department of Justice, their civil rights divisions can be restructured in a way that they're actually advocating for more civil rights as opposed to working against them.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of things that can be done, and I think at least some of them will be done. So that's the end on a promising note.
Thank you. It's good to hear some optimism and some concrete proposals and sort of inspiring ideas coming through.
Well, thank you guys for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for volunteering your time. We really appreciate it.
And all your work with the Civil Rights Project.
Absolutely.
For faithfully following them out to LA. We appreciate your time and your work as well. Thank you.
Okay, take care. Thanks.
All right, thanks again. Bye.
That was Genevieve Siegel-Hawley of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA.
To make a call, press 1.
And
to purchase additional
there's
minutes.
The calling card.